Good morning, witches. This is the Witch Daily Show, coming to you from New Orleans, with host Tanya Brown. Our episodes span about 20 minutes long to give you just a little pop of magic. So, tune in, take a deep breath, and enjoy.
We have a special segment today. We are talking with occult expert, presenter, singer, psychic, and author of more than 30 books on paranormal topics, Michelle Boulanger. Michelle has been featured on TV shows, including A&E's Paranormal State, The Travel Channel's Portals to Hell, as a psychic medium and occult expert. Michelle's nonfiction research in books like The Dictionary of Demons and The Psychic Vampire Codex has been sourced in television shows, university courses, and publications around the world. We are just so lucky to have Michelle on today, and it's just so cool. So hi, Michelle. Thank you for coming and saying hi to us today.
Hey, thank you. Hopefully it's not too warm down where you're at.
It's very hot and sticky and horrible. Where are you abouts?
I am not too far off of the shores of Lake Erie in Ohio. Mm. So,
oh my gosh.
Muggy, oh. But not quite bayou muggy.
Yeah, not peeling your clothes off as you're cringing, muggy. Ooh. So I'm super excited. I was telling you before we started recording that if I had found your books when I was younger, my head would have exploded. I think it's like everything I always wanted as like a younger person, especially diving into the occult, having such an interest in the paranormal and entities and stuff like that, like the your demon book, and then all of your ghost hunting, and which I don't love saying ghost hunting. You're fine with it?
Well, it's the most popular term, but I do think that whether people mean to internalize a sort of like adversarial approach from it, I think language matters, and if we like really step back and think of it as ghost hunting, that suggests that we're like going, trying to poke things or track them down or capture them like something from Ghostbusters, when really going someplace to explore. I mean, for me, it's a lot more about opening dialogues and, you know, having communication and being open to experience and not necessarily assuming from the start that it's going to be negative in any way.
Yeah, even just saying it, I've always kind of cringed a little bit because it kind of feels like we're looking for werewolves, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's always just kind of like a weird vibe. So you have been featured on Paranormal State and Portals to Hell, which I think we had an episode here, Portals to Hell, that featured on the Lullaree House. A friend of mine actually PA'd on that. So we got to like hear about how it all went. So you have over 2 decades of paranormal research under your belt. So I guess one of my big questions as someone who was like watching these shows from the birth of them coming out, how have you seen paranormal research and this seeking of communicating with ghosts and spirits kind of change over the years?
Oh, let's see. I came of age as a researcher and investigator during the height of the satanic panic. Mm. So like there was this time where it was, if it was acceptable at all, like you were still looked at as potentially dabbling in Satanism, opening doors, like literal portals to hell. And with the advent of the shows on TV, I think it normalized and made more accessible the concept that the paranormal doesn't have to be this dark, scary, intimidating thing. And then it can be something that anyone can do.
So that was actually, that actually perfectly goes into a question from one of our listeners, George Ann. She was wondering, with more and more people kind of getting into this, wanting to communicate with spirits and maybe going to locations and doing their own investigations, with more and more people doing that who may be more novice, do you, as someone who is just highly knowledgeable about this, have any concerns as to like what could come along with that?
I mean, my only concern ever is if people are doing it insincerely or as if it's like a joke. Like if you go in expecting trouble, or if you're going in to try to like mock it, or literally trying to scare yourself by poking the bear, you are likely to have an experience that isn't very fun. And I'd say that my bigger concern there is like, what effect can that have on anybody going with you who might be more serious about it, or who is looking for a different experience? So, you know, take it seriously, read up, like do some research. Don't only like hit up Wikipedia or like one website, like be as open to multiple points of view as possible. And above all, go with this. If you entertain the notion that ghosts exist and that they are the remnants of human beings, there's no point at which they've stopped being human, so treat them as such.
That's a really nice way to say it, because I think I've been that person in a group who is taking it very seriously. And it was a few years ago, but we did in... It was kind of like a tour, but it was like an investigation at St. Vincent's, which is this hotel that used to be like an orphanage. And me and my friend went, and we had a good time. And I definitely felt like that I had an experience. The issue was, is that it was primarily a tourist attraction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people there were just very jokey, mocky, being obnoxious. And ever since I had that experience, that changed me, I think. Like seeing people be so disrespectful really soured like a lot of that for me. So if there is someone listening who's like, well, I want to experience this, but they don't want to have my experience, how should people kind of go about that?
Vet who you're going with. And, you know, if you're going with a tour group, like read up on the tour group, like figure out like who is the tour guide? What is their style? If they've got a website, look at the website. Do they look more theatrical than they are just let's investigate the history of the location? You know, everything is going to have a different flavor and a different approach. I've gone on a couple of the tours down in New Orleans. I had friends who were tour guides, one of whom is definitely not a tour guide anymore. He got into some trouble and well-deserved, and I won't even bring that up because it's a whole thing. Lord Chaz Howell, if you're familiar with
him. No, I've heard nothing about this.
I don't want to, I honestly don't want to bring it because it was like big wild thing, but it actually is an important point of do a little research on the person who is guiding you. And you know, reviews online are always questionable because anybody can leave stuff, and like there is that tendency to like just do almost like guerrilla warfare with 1-star reviews if somebody was a little too something that you didn't agree with. But if something doesn't vibe with you, if you're just like, no, this doesn't seem like my thing, look for something that does. But more than that, go with people that you trust and that you know have the same approach that you do.
So speaking of reviews, I heard that your Airbnb is haunted, and I really want to know how those reviews are. Are they like what comments are people leaving on your Airbnb?
So it started out, we bought this place to run classes. I do a lot of dream work, and I wanted a place where people could do like a weekend retreat and do dreaming stuff and have a couple of nights where they slept in the same location. But then the pandemic happened. And so doing in-person stuff became problematic. So we're like, we can do an Airbnb thing. Like we're super hosts. We do all that stuff. And at first we didn't mention that it was haunted. And we got some interesting feedback. Only one person was like 100% not okay about it. Like he and his family stayed there, and within hours he had his wife and his kids somewhere else, and he was like on the phone with us, and he was just so upset. Usually it's more polite, like kind of not in the review so much as a private message. My favorite one was this person who was in town for like a music conservatory event. So she's there for like a week, and she fell asleep on the couches, and it's like late fall here in Ohio, and it was a warmer day, so she had the windows open. And as it got colder, it got like really cold. She woke up, all the windows had been closed, and somebody had tucked a blanket around her. She was the only person in the house.
That's pretty good.
So since we didn't say, like, you know, this is a haunted place, she was like, I don't know, because they didn't know it was mine. She's like, I don't know if you know this, but I think that the house is haunted. I mean, it seems like it's a really nice haunting. And so we sat down, my wife and I were like, so maybe we should just be like, hi, Airbnb. Yes, this is a Scarebnb. It is, in fact, a haunted house. It is mostly an okay haunting. But if you're not down for footsteps at 3 a.m. and the music box randomly playing and occasionally somebody calling your name, then you're probably not going to want to stay here.
That's super fair. Like, yeah, that's fair. I mean, I definitely feel like you should get the choice on if you want to be down for that experience. But I think there's a lot of people. I mean, I don't know about Ohio, but I feel like when people come here, they would love that. They'd be so into it.
Most people are. Ohio is surprisingly haunted. There are a lot of paranormal locations, and an awful lot of paranormal people have come from Ohio. It's just a weird state. Maybe it's because there's not a lot to do around here. But, you know, between my Airbnb and like the Buckland Witchcraft Museum and Mansfield, and like, again, within less than an hour driving distance, like there's like 5 different locations just from Inspiration House. And almost everybody's totally okay with it, but I think consent is important. So if you know a place is haunted, if you know a place has a certain feel or a vibe to it that people are going to have a reaction to, at the very least, you should let them know so that they can buy into it or be like, nope, not my thing. There are a couple of little signs that I have up around the house. Probably the most important thing for me is I've got a big thing that's directions of, like, if you feel overwhelmed, here are some tips of what to do. Here's how to protect yourself. Here's how to ground and center. And, you know, if all else fails, just give us a call.
That's really cool. That is super cool. I like, in my head, I'm imagining like these big plaques on the walls, which is like instructions on how to deal with ghosts. That's super cool. So actually, you just reminded me of a question. It was not planned. Like, it wasn't a question we thought of. But it's actually a question from one of our listeners who asked me last week, and I really didn't know what to tell them. And it just occurred to me now that, like, you might be the person to ask, if you don't mind. She basically said that she experiences this entity, and she was calling them like a house spirit, but they keep moving with her from location to location. And then she says that sometimes she feels like she can hear like the walls whispering to her. And my first instinct was, that feels more like a poltergeist if it's following you, but I feel like you probably know more than I do.
There's some interesting history about house spirits or hearth spirits that will like follow a person, that kind of like make a connection to a person. I was raised by like first and second generation Irish Americans. And so there's fairies as well that are part of that, where like there's brownies and whatnot that were these spirits. They're really, they've got turned into fairies, but they're a remnant of pre-Christian beliefs of little guardians that you would make a connection with. And if they liked you and you moved houses, they would come with you to continue to look after the family and the people that they had a bond with. And again, you'll see things like this kind of in world mythology all over the place. if it's mischievous and throwing things around and sometimes being a little mean about it, I might consider Poltergeist. It's from German, noisy spirit. There's some debate about what a poltergeist is. I would say that on like the popular idea of a poltergeist is it's a mischievous spirit, probably non-human, that gets up to stuff and, you know, messes with your electronics and throws things around, breaks the crockery. In the early 20th century and later 1800s, the idea of a poltergeist was, there was some debate that it was actually the person unconsciously causing it. The idea that especially somebody who's an adolescent or a pubescent person who sometimes has trauma, sometimes is just going through some emotional stuff and has latent psychic ability that is uncontrolled and unaddressed and is sort of like coming out in these eruptions of psychokinetic force. Depending on who you talk to, poltergeists fall into either category or both.
That's really interesting. I have heard that theory before, and I've heard it be used to explain quite a few things. But something you touched on that that reminded me of something else. I told you, I am like this is really like my niche. So you mentioned where there are people who believe that poltergeists could be like a projection or like an extension of oneself. How, like, and this is one thing I've never been able to get a solid answer on in all of my time. Shadow people. Mm. What are your thoughts on shadow people?
I do not fall into the belief that all shadow people are the same thing. I have experienced ordinary human spirits, like, you know, dead Uncle Joe, who just wasn't very good at projecting how he looked. And so he would seem only like a human shadow and easily mistaken for a shadow person. So sometimes it's a matter of the spirit's ability to project their appearance. Sometimes it's a matter of the perceiver, the living person, and what they are able to interpret from their perceptions. So like the best your mind's eye can manage in clarity is this vaguely human shape that seems, you know, indistinct and shadowy. And then there are a couple of experiences that I've had with something that seems definitely non-human, human shaped in a way that seems like something very awkwardly put on a human suit, possibly with the attempt of blending in, but it does so badly. Yeah, shadow people are almost like the men in black of the paranormal, like ghost hunting side of things, where they just seem like these weird alien interlopers that just kind of like move through stuff and clearly don't belong. I've heard a couple of very convincing stories about them at Waverly Hills, and I've seen a couple. You know, I don't always remember the names of the places they take me to when I'm blindfolded. Certainly something that I thought was a shadow person on one of the paranormal, one of the Portals of Hell episodes, and something at Mansfield Reformatory that seemed taller than you would expect a regular person. And again, that uncanny, like, this looks human-shaped, but like it's faking it badly. And my personal theory on those is that they're what I'll term outsiders. They're interdimensional, transdimensional, like something that's not from here. I don't quite think of them as like aliens in the sense of like something that came down from a UFO, but something that intersects with our reality but isn't originally from it. Might be curious, might be a traveler, but, you know, didn't land in a UFO, like moves between like a spirit.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. That definitely aligns with quite a few theories that I've heard. And yeah, I would just forever be fascinated by shadow people, because it really feels like this depth. So, you know, okay. So, you know, like when people say, if you go down deep into the like the ocean far enough, you start getting like things that we can't know or explain. That's kind of how I feel about shadow people. Like I feel like they are this depth of that, like, I really want us to know more about, but I don't know if we ever will.
No, I would agree with that. Like I said, I think that there are some things that people identify as shadow people that are just a regular garden variety spirit that the way we're perceiving it seems like a silhouette or a shadow. And then there are some things that are just, well, that ain't right. And I don't know what it is. And I can give you a lot of theories, but, you know, they're only theories. And some of them are like educated guesses, but I do not have enough information. I'm not sure any of us do.
So speaking of like things that like try to pretend like they're human, this is a question from one of our listeners, Andrea. Andrea asks, in researching and writing your books on demons, I'm sure a lot of intention, energy, and focus got put into that process of collecting and organizing data. Have you ever accidentally summoned a demon you weren't familiar with in the book writing process? But she said because it would 100% happen to her.
I have never accidentally summoned a demon. Part of it, I think, the approach with the Dictionary of Demons is more an academic approach. I have a degree in comparative religious studies and went to a Jesuit Catholic college. So I learned demonology from the Jesuits. I have, in fact, sat in on and assisted with traditional Catholic exorcisms, partly with Paranormal State, but also outside of that. And not only Catholic exorcism. So my approach to demons isn't really theological. I'm fascinated by all the different theories people have about what these entities are. I come at it more from the perspective of an occultist and a person with a ceremonial magical interest. My first delving into demons and demonology was as like a 13, 14-year-old kid who picked up a copy of the book called The Magus, and it was the first place where I started to see stuff on the Solomonic tradition. So, of course, as a teenager, I played around with it, like, you know, and poked around at stuff like that and tried to rope other friends in middle school and high school into summoning demons, like you do.
Like you do.
With mixed results. Nothing ever got so far out of hand that I felt truly scared. That's not everybody's experience. And I will say that your mileage may vary depending on a whole lot of factors. But I think the most important one is how scared you are. Like if you are certain that a terrible thing is going to happen, that certainly helps terrible things to focus on you from that side. Like, they're interested in that sort of energy.
So you touched on something that we've never actually have touched on the show before, mostly because we've just never have had a reason to, but I think it's really important. And here's the thing, you can also bow out of like trying to explain this. So you touched on how there are different ways to look at demons. There's the theological way in terms of, especially within like, you know, Christianity, especially within Catholicism, but demons in terms of occultism, in terms of like, you know, Seal of Solomon, like Crowley, like the whole ceremonial magic is like a completely different thing. Are you able to, because I don't know if I have the words to explain the difference. Can you like explain the difference?
I will try to do it in like 500 words or less, which is very, very difficult. So there's the Christian approach of angels and demons, which is rooted in Christian dualism. There's good, there's evil, black and white. There's no in between. There's, you know, angelic beings, and then there's whatever is damned and from hell. And that's honestly a fairly tiny, limited view of things that inherits concepts and in many ways has warped and twisted them. Christianity got a lot of its ideas of angels and I'm going to say evil spirits, not necessarily demons, from Judaism. In Judaism, there's no such thing as a fallen angel. All the angels have roles assigned to them, and it's their very essence. So while there are angels that could be evil, angels that bring about evil things, they're not quite the same. And Jewish angelology and demonology comes from older sources still. And that gets into this really fascinating realm of spirits, where it's more about what a spirit's essence and basically their job is. Like what is their job description? And their job description is also what they are, who they are. It's tied to their name, their essence, their sigil, everything. And in the ancient world, predominantly ancient Western world, so Babylon, Sumer, Egypt, whatnot, you had these non-human entities that were sort of gods. Many of them were children of gods that occupied this interesting space between humanity and the actual worship deities. They had different things that they were in charge of. They brought storms, they brought disease, but they were also the ones that could cure those things. So our idea of demons from a folkloric and mythic standpoint is the inheritance of this very ancient way of arranging spirits. Growing out of that and sort of woven through it is what's called the Solomonic tradition. That is an Abrahamic, so you'll find it in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It revolves around King Solomon and the idea that he was the wisest of kings and God gave him this awesome ring and he was able to summon, bind, banish, and compel spirits. In Christianity, those spirits are demons, Judaism as well. In Islam, they're genies. But if you dig further and further into that, those spirits are inextricable from those older sources of Egyptian, Sumerian, and Babylonian ideas of these things that existed in the sort of betwixt and between humanity and the gods. All of that gives us the Solomonic tradition of ceremonial magic passed down and enlarged and enriched throughout medieval and Renaissance Europe. And it gets super complicated, but probably the most recognizable bits are the goetic entities. 72 specifically named demonic beings who are summoned as tutors in most ways. They teach you logic and they teach you mathematics and they teach you the language of birds. And the very fact that you're summoning these, you know, quote unquote demons to basically learn stuff or to gain favor with kings and princes belies the fact that they weren't originally these fallen beings. They were these tutelary spirits that, again, occupy that weird space in between. So obviously it's a topic that I spend a lot of time with. I've dug very, very deep to, like, where is the oldest root that we can find with this? And it's old Egyptian astrological creatures attached to the decans of the zodiac. And it's just fascinating stuff. It is such a foundational part of Western mythology, and it's just really poorly understood. We tend to, at this point, at least in pop culture and sort of in pop paranormal culture, really minimalize it. Like it's reduced down to, a demon! It's an evil entity that's going to suck your soul, and it's much more complicated than that.
Thank you so much for explaining that, because I know we're never going to have someone who can lay it out as well as you just did. And it is a really important, especially for witches who are listening or occultists. And even if they may never delve into that realm, I think just having that foundation of knowledge is really amazing. So thank you so much. Like, even as I was asking, I'm asking you a lot of, like, you know, of Michelle, but thank you. I really appreciate it.
Whenever people ask me stuff like that, the thing to keep in mind with the paranormal, supernatural, and occult is we have labels, but a lot of those are loan words and sort of borrowed concepts because we don't have good things, you know, in our culture. We don't have a background with a lot of this. And it is essential to understand what a person means, like what their specific connotation and background and baggage with a particular term they're using is. Because if I went on an investigation and it was a pagan family and they were talking about demons, it might be something that they were intentionally working with that they don't see and had no intention to see as negative. But if it is an evangelical family, they're going to have a very different idea of what a demon is. And I think it's also essential to acknowledge that fundamentalist Christianity, everything is a demon. If it's here and it is supernatural by default with certain extreme sects of Christianity, everything is demonic, which is why they are very intimidated by any of the stuff that we might do and see it as satanic or occult. Even talking to your great-grandma, and you know it's great-grandma, from that perspective, that's a demon because nothing can exist here that isn't somehow fallen or tainted. So understanding people's backgrounds, understanding the different belief systems, all of that I think is essential to understanding, you know, what we're talking about when we use these different words.
Yeah, because very often we just use words that are available to us, even if they're not perfectly in line with like what we're actually, you know, like discussing or, you know, like talking about. I would love to shift into another topic that you write on quite a bit, and that is vampires. I live in New Orleans, so we have quite a culture here, and so I'm just super fascinated. Also, your book, The Psychic Vampire Codex, is about to celebrate its 20th year anniversary, right? Or did we mess up the math?
Yeah, well, it depends on which version, because the first version was written in 94. And then there was a wiser version that was published in 2004. So yeah, we're moving to the 20th anniversary for
the second edition.
For the wiser edition.
Man, well, the other one is older than 20 years. So what's really cool about this book is kind of how you approached it in terms, it was done in a really unique way where it was kind of written for vampires, but there's like this really cool grounded myth and history that's in there as well, which I don't think you would see now, much less 20-ish years ago. So what inspired you to approach this work this way?
So I'm a psychic vampire, and for some people that's like a you know, it's as scary a word as demon. Also, honestly, why I'm not really too scared about poking around at demons or occult stuff, because nothing we think is dark and spooky is usually as dark and spooky as we think it is. So a psychic vampire is a person who needs to regularly and actively take human vital energy to maintain their health and well-being. There's a whole community of folks like me. It is just one more flavor of psychic. All of the psychic stuff people see me do on television with any of the shows, that I have those abilities because of what I am. I was born this way. It's arguable that it runs in the family, like a lot of other psychic abilities. And it's something that I do only with consent. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but the Psychic Vampire Codex needed to be out there because I needed that book when I was 14 and trying to figure myself out, and it did not exist. The only books I was able to find when I was trying to understand what my abilities were and why they had this particular quirk to them were self-defense texts. Like, I found terms of like psychic vampires, and I use that term to make it really clear. We're not talking Lestat or Dracula. I'm not undead. I have slept in a coffin, but only because I was in a production of Oliver, and it was just fun to like sneak naps in the coffin in between stuff because it freaked out the other people in the thing. So the ideas of like Dion Fortune's psychic self-defense, where she talks about psychic vampires and astral vampires as just inherently evil beings, like there was no way to be this and not be a horrible predator. And, you know, I'm reading this and I'm like 17, 18, and I'm like, but I'm not that. Like, that's not how these things work for me. And it just became very clear that I needed to write the book because nobody else had. And I fought. It was not an easy argument to get that published by a third-party publisher. The reason why it's like there's an earlier version is for 10 years it was an underground publication. It was self-published. It was, you know, part of like the zine culture that was a big thing in like the late 80s and early 90s. These were copies that were handed out at clubs and, you know, little like occult meetings and whatnot and passed around the country. Ultimately, a version of it was published on an AOL webpage, like way back in the day. And then the book like was published by a third party publisher. Just because I needed to put that perspective out there, but also put the possibility in the hands of people who have this ability that they don't necessarily have to see themselves as wrong or broken. They don't have to be predatory because they, you know, somebody says it that you can't not be. And more than anything else, I wanted to give them the choice.
It's funny because I think we still see that term used very negatively. I actually don't know if just from hearing people speak or reading, if I've really ever seen it talked about in a way that's like morally neutral. So because there's so many people who write in or talk and they always, you know, will say, oh, I think my coworker or someone I'm around a lot is a psychic vampire. So I'm also wondering if maybe we have a misunderstanding of what that actually means and how we can differentiate between maybe someone who just bugs us, which I think it's very highly often used for, versus someone who may be more like you, who relies on this like energetic exchange.
Well, I mean, we started this interview off with, you know, language matters. Ghost hunting has some baggage with it because of the idea of hunting and the sort of sensationalism. And the same problem is with the word vampire. Trust me when I say the community from the early 90s and probably before wrestled with that because there's a lot of baggage that comes with the word vampire, but we don't have a better word in the English language to describe someone who feeds off of life. And there's some really interesting, weird historical kind of interactions and bleed over that I could get into with like Bram Stoker writing fiction and the fictional Dracula, but using a lot of his concepts, drawing from the occult revival of the time and the ideas from the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn of psychic vampires, and the high likelihood that at least somebody at a dinner party suggested that Sir Henry Irving was a psychic vampire. And further back, Lord Byron. Like there's this interesting reciprocity between real living people, real like occult or psychic experiences, and then what people fictionalize out of that in order to give it context. Because the folkloric vampire is a really different thing, like a completely different animal. You know, where we're at now, there are people who are psychic vampires who have all of these abilities, are probably not conscious about it, and are exactly that person you're talking about, like the universal pain in the neck at the office who just sucks everybody dry. And you recognize like something's happening when you interact with them, or that relative who just like sucks you in and won't let you get off the couch and tells you everything that's wrong in their life. And like by the time you're done, like you just feel completely drained by them. And it's the same capacity, it's the same ability, and the difference is consent and like conscious intention. For me, I've always championed the idea within the vampire community, a concept that I borrowed from the witchcraft community, which is reclaiming. When the witchcraft community was trying to like really establish itself as, you know, not just a bunch of satanic old women meeting in the woods to kiss Satan's ass, making a clear distinction from the folkloric and medieval concept of witchcraft and what a witch actually is, they didn't want to lose the term. There was a lot of power to that word, and a lot of power to the archetype of someone who was inherently magical, someone who had this sort of like communal connection to not only the land, but also the spirits of the land, and the ability to like raise it up and summon it and have an interaction with it. And the same with vampire. Is there some utility in finding other terms for it, or just acknowledging that sometimes people don't have good boundaries and maybe should just work on that?
Not gonna lie, that's usually just our advice.
Yeah.
It's boundaries. So I guess I was gonna go with one question. Now I'm leaning into a different question. If there's someone listening right now who had maybe had that experience, like you did when, you know, you were younger and you're starting to notice these things, but again, like every book is being like, you know, defend, defend. What, other than picking up a resource, you know, like your book, what is kind of the first step in getting comfortable with the, you know, those psychic abilities?
I can speak to what I did and what worked for me, which was I started to go, hey, I think I can do this thing. I think this thing is happening. Some of it, I didn't like the effect I was having on people. So first, I just stepped back and observed as much as I could. You know, I journaled a lot and I paid close attention. How do I feel when I'm in certain environments? How do I feel when I'm interacting with people? What is my internal landscape like, and how does it change when I am exposed to different energies and different experiences or different environments? And in understanding, you know, how everything inside my head worked, just my emotions and my just sort of like regular everyday baseline, and how that shifted if I was in a crowd of people or if I was in a house that people said was haunted. That started to let me get a sense of how it spoke to me in subtle and quiet ways. And in bringing it into awareness, I also brought it into a realm of more conscious control. I started to find more or less like the dial control of like, okay, I've got these psychic abilities. I'm sensitive to people's emotions. I'm sensitive to the feel of a location. I don't have to have it on all the time. I don't have to be overwhelmed by it. Good mental boundaries and emotional boundaries were essential. Like learning, like, where do I begin and end, and where is the rest of the world, and how do I guard that? And when is it appropriate to let that guard down to get a little bit more information? So it's not a simple process, but I find it incredibly enriching. And it does, it just involves a lot of work of like, get to know yourself.
I mean, that's just great advice in terms of all occultism, mm-hmm. You know, like nothing worthy is simple, right? Like it is a journey of, like figuring things out and like you having to figure things out. And, I have found a lot of people new to witchcraft or, I mean, any kind of personal thing like this really want, it like laid out like in steps mm-hmm. or classes, and then you take 20 credits and you you've done it, you've mastered it. And that's it. There is like this nitty grittiness of it all of like having to figure out inside of you.
Yeah. I've been doing this a long time. I've read a lot of books and I've written a lot of books, and I am here to tell you that there is no single book that's going to have all the answers for you and is going to just magically tell you how it works. Because the first thing you have to understand what works is how do you work? And no one can write that book but you. Like, you need to know how you work and how you interface with the world. And it's going to be different for everybody. I know like neurodivergence is a big like topic now, and we're becoming much more aware that none of us think the same way. None of us emote or process the world the same way. And this is honestly a beautiful thing, but it means that there's no book, none, that will be able to tell you exactly how you experience these things. You have to start with yourself first. And take from as many sources as possible, and don't be afraid to be like, this doesn't resonate with me. I find that this person is supposed to be very, very authoritative, and my friends tell me I should respect them. You know, it doesn't mean that they're wrong. It means that they're wrong for you, and that's okay.
Thank you for coming in here and just like laying that down, because yes, I feel like so many people are trying to explain this. And I mean, I get it. We all were new, and we all just wanted the magic pamphlet that like, you know, took us from A to B. But yeah, the truth is it's so different for everybody, and it's not, you know, a 1-year journey. It's going to be like for the rest of your life, because you're always learning about yourself and figuring yourself out and how you work and process. And yeah. Oh, so true. So my last question for you, you mentioned a bit ago about conscious control. You have a class that you're doing called The Magic of Dreams. Talk about conscious control. Can you tell us more about that class?
I do so much dream work, and it goes hand in hand with that bringing things into consciousness. So the class is sort of a crash course in the paranormal aspect of dreams, the psychological reality of like why we dream and how we dream, and how to recognize the difference between just memory consolidation, which is one of the primary functions of our ordinary dreams, is to just move information from like short-term memory to long-term memory. And as it's moving, that we see stuff, like we experience it. But there are so many other sides to that. Dreams historically have been this liminal place where we are able to communicate with spirits, the gods, places of prophecy, places of climactic emergency communication, spontaneous telepathy. So in the course of this, we look into lucid dreaming, like how do we bring our dreams into a more conscious place? How do we dream with more intention? How do we first start to even remember our dreams, because not everybody does? And then what toolkit does that open us up to? Like, what can we do with these things? And I'm here to tell you that you can use dreams to talk with spirits, and you can use dreams to talk with one another. You can use your dreaming mind to go in and then travel out for various out-of-body experiences. You don't have to be asleep and dreaming. There's these fascinating mental altered states of consciousness, hypnagogic states, where you're not quite asleep and you're not quite awake, and there's enough of a shift in the way your brain works, just the simple way you process reality, that it opens you up to so many abilities that ordinarily your conscious brain sort of shuts down because they're not relevant to going to work and, you know, punching a clock and just like arranging reality the way that you must in order to interact with the waking world that we're all sort of obligated to pay rent and drive down the street with.
It's really fascinating that you touched on that space of being not quite awake and not, you know, like quite asleep. Because I have like, you know, for me personally, I have found that that space is where everything is, like where like everything lies. And it's such a, and I've always really wanted to try to shift what can be done there a little bit more to waking state. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so you have a class on that on dream magic. And from what it sounds, yeah, it sounds really great. I think I'm gonna sign up, because I'm like, I need to like I need to become a little bit more fluid at that, because yeah, I think you are 100% correct on just like the power there. And, you know, with like getting into lucid dreaming, which can lead to like astral projection and, all of that, it's really fascinating. So if someone, wants to take that class? Like, where can they go find it?
It's up on my website. It's also something that is sort of folded into a couple of the tiers because I have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/haunted. That's where I do most of my classes. Like, everybody gets like the first dibs there. And can sometimes be like, hey, I'm looking to learn about this thing. And I'll be like, yeah, I could do a class on that. Let's put that together. We've got a really fun community of folks who are all, you know, on this path together and just diverse and interested and, you know, chit-chatting with one another. So my website, the Patreon, michellebelanger.com/classes, I think. Yes. Events, sorry. Yep. michellebelanger.com/events.
Awesome. So actually, we'll have a link to both your website and your Patreon in our podcast episode description so people can find it. And yeah, thank you so much. Can I just say, like, you are one of the coolest people I think we've ever talked to. And this was really a wonderful treat. And I always get super psyched when we have people on who are as, you know, like, knowledgeable as you are. So thank you so much for coming on.
No, thank you for having me. It's been a good conversation. And for tolerating the fact, like I can't do the demon thing in a small amount of time. Like, there's so much. It's the reason why I wrote a book that was like 200,000 words long.
Witches, we hope you have a wonderful day, full of joy and gentleness and confidence. Links for this week's episodes, our website, Patreon, along with a free daily card pull can be found at witchpod.com. One stop for everything we talk about. Now, take one more deep breath and have a great day.